Okay, so now everybody can leave. So I should start by saying that the stuff I'm going to talk about is joint work with Tarek Balaban, who's at Rutgers, and Horst Knorr and Eugene Trubowitz of the ETH. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a way to represent quantities in a certain class of models as integrals, and I'll start off by explaining what the physical system is that these models are supposed to describe. I'll be very sort of hand-wavy to try to make this accessible to non-experts. So the system of interest is a gas of very small particles. By a small particle, what I mean is something where quantum mechanical effects are important. Now, there are basically two types of quantum mechanical particles, bosons and fermions, and I'm going to be interested in bosons. If you don't know the significance of that, don't worry about it. I'll sneak it in at the right place. Now, to set up a model for such a system, probably the most important thing we need to know is we need to specify where the energy comes from in the system. And there are going to be two sources of energy. First of all, each particle has got a kinetic energy. Now, in quantum mechanics, an observable-like energy is represented by an operator. And in fact, for the purpose of today's talk, we can allow a very general class of operators for this kinetic energy. Basically, any positive definite operator. But in applications, by far, most people, when they talk about the kinetic energy of a particle, they mean the quantum mechanical analog of the classical potential energy, which is momentum squared divided by twice the mass. And in quantum mechanics, the momentum operator gets replaced by some constants times gradient, I times the gradient. So when you square it, you get minus the Laplacian divided by twice the mass. The second source of energy is that there's an interaction between the particles. So if you've got a particle at x and a particle at y, there's going to be a potential energy that I'm going to call V of xy between those two particles. Again, we'll be able to have a very general class of potential energies, except for one important feature, and that is for the system to be stable, we're going to need that this force, which corresponds to this potential energy, be a repulsive force. So that's where the energy comes from in this gas. Now, we're going to assume that the gas is in thermodynamic equilibrium, a specific type of thermodynamic equilibrium called the grand canonical ensemble. What that means is you have the system of interest, which is this gas, but in addition, you have a huge heat bath out there, and this heat bath can exchange both energy and particles with the system of primary interest. So that means that the energy of this gas is not fixed at one value, but there's a probability distribution which tells you what the probability is that the system has any given energy. And in fact, in the grand canonical ensemble, there's a one parameter family of allowed probability distributions, and the parameter is the temperature. We're going to allow more or less any temperature, but in fact, the temperatures of interest in this system are the temperatures that are very close to zero. Similarly, the number of particles in the system is not fixed. You can exchange particles between the gas and the heat bath. So again, particle number is not fixed, but there's a probability density for having any given number of particles. And once again, in the grand canonical ensemble, there's actually a one parameter family of probability distributions. And the parameter is called the chemical potential. Here it is. Chemical potential mu. Again, we're going to allow more or less any chemical potential, but it's going to turn out that the physically interesting chemical potentials are those that are negative, not those that are positive. All right, so that's our system. Now, to set up a quantum mechanical model of such a system, there are two things you need to specify. One is you need to have the thing that represents all of the possible states of the system, and that's a Hilbert space. There is a specific Hilbert space that that's involved. But for us, the only sort of structure we need to know about this Hilbert space is that it's going to be an orthogonal direct sum of subspaces. I'm going to call it F. The subspace is F sub n. N runs over the values 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. The subspace F sub n is the set of states that you would have if you knew that there were exactly n particles. So that gives the set of states of the system. Then you need to have things which tell you the observables, the things that you measure. Observables in quantum mechanics are given by operators. We're only going to need two observables. And I'm not actually going to write them down explicitly, but I'll give you the information that we need about them as we go along. So one observable is the Hamiltonian, which gives the energy of the entire system. As I say, there's a specific operator that you write down, but I'll just tell you how that it's built out of the kinetic energies of each of the individual particles. You add them all together, and you add to that the potential energies between all pairs of particles. And then finally, there the other observable that we need, and this one is so simple that I can actually tell you exactly what it is. It's the number operator, which measures the number of particles in the system. And this number operator is defined by saying that if you restrict the particle to the subspace which corresponds to having exactly n particles, then the operator is just n times the identity operator on that subspace. Okay, so that is the physical setting that we have. That's the model. Now, there are a number of things that you can build out of this, quantities of interest. And just to make things simple, I'm going to concentrate on a single quantity of interest. And that's going to be something that's called the partition function. So, okay, so I'll use this as the backup screen. So the main quantity that we're going to be interested in fact, for this talk, the only quantity that we're going to be interested in is called the partition function. And it's the way you define it is you take the two operators we know about, the Hamiltonian and the number operator, and you take H, that's the Hamiltonian, minus mu, that's the chemical potential, times the number operator, multiply them by beta. Beta is aside from a constant, it's 1 over the temperature, so it represents the temperature. Take e to the minus that, and then you take the trace of the result. So what I'm going to do is, shortly I'm going to have a theorem which gives a representation for this object in terms of an integral. Nope, wrong way. They were. There, is that better? Okay, so I'm going to give a state of theorem which gives a representation for this as an integral, or in terms of integrals, and these are integrals that, in fact, you could define in a second-year calculus course and actually work with. Now, this representation is a rigorous version of an integral representation that you'll find in more or less any textbook on condensed matter physics. I'd like to start off by writing down the formal integral that you'll see in a textbook, in a physics textbook, and discuss it before getting to the rigorous version of it, and that's going to be the theorem that I will show you. All right, so if you open up a textbook on condensed matter physics, you'll probably see a formula that looks something like this top line. The left-hand side is our partition function. Actually, I think maybe this is not worth it. All right, so the top line, we have on the left-hand side the partition function, on the right-hand side something that looks like an integral. Okay, now I should spend a little time to describe what's going on in this integral. We have a measure.
Isn't it clear that the operator is a trace quantum?
No. We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, yeah. It's Ken's fault. No, in fact, I mean, what I'm going to say at the end of this page is, in fact, you have to go to a lot of effort to define both sides of this thing. All right, so, but first of all, it's going to be pretty obvious that you're going to have to put a lot of effort into the right-hand side as soon as I explain what the right-hand side is. So first of all, let's take a look at this measure, this d phi star phi. So this is a Lebesgue measure, but it's a Lebesgue measure in uncountably many variables. So here it is written out. You'll see two parameters appearing on the right-hand side. There's a parameter x, which represents a point in space, and it runs over all of R3. And there's a parameter tau here, which I'm going to call time, and it runs over an interval from 0 to beta. Remember, beta is basically 1 over temperature. Now, it's not quite true. There's a periodicity condition, so in fact, tau equals 0 and tau equals beta are really the same. Now, if you take any one point x in space and one value of time tau, then you've got one integration variable which is running over the complex plane. So this thing here, you'd probably write this as d phi star wedge d phi. This is the ordinary two-dimensional Lebesgue measure, two real-dimensional Lebesgue measure on the complex plane viewed as R2, except for a factor of 1 over pi, which is harmless. So we have this sort of Lebesgue measure in a very large number of variables, and then we've got an integrand, and the integrand is an exponential of a pretty explicit function of all of the different integration variables. The details of this thing aren't going to matter very much to us. I'll just point out that they contain the sort of information that you would have from the left-hand side. You have here this H is the kinetic energy operator viewed as an integral operator. So this is the kernel of H viewed as an integral, when you view the operator H as an integral operator. Here we have the chemical potential mu. Here's our potential energy V appearing. So the integrand is something that's fairly harmless. But it's clear that we're going to have to put a lot of effort into trying to get something that we can actually define properly for the right-hand side. Okay. Now, in fact, it's also true that you have to put a lot of effort just into defining the left-hand side as well. The reason is that this innocent-sounding model that I set up is actually a model which has some very interesting physics going on. And in fact, there is going to be some symmetry breaking phenomena going on. So what that means is, in order to define the left-hand side, you've got to be very careful. Now, there is a procedure that you go through to attempt to define the left-hand side, and that procedure is a lot like the way you define a Riemann integral. I suppose you want to define the integral of an area underneath a graph. What you do is you take this complicated area and you approximate it by something that's obviously well-defined, namely the sum of the areas of a finite number of rectangles, and then you take a limit where the rectangles get closer and closer and closer together. To define this left-hand side, you do exactly the same thing, except you replace the entire model by a model which is obviously well-defined and attempt to take the limit. Now, there are a number of ways of doing this. The way that I'm going to use, and one of the standard ways, is I'm going to take space, which in the application we're interested in space being R3. I'm going to approximate R3 by a finite number of points. Now, of course, it's going to be a large number of points, and eventually we're going to take a limit in which these points fill out all of R3. But taking that limit is actually a very hard problem. And the goal today is a much narrower problem. I'm going to take any fixed finite number of points as my space. And I want to get a formula like this, which I know to be valid when space has only got finitely many points in it. And then at that point, you want to have a representation you can then analyze and attempt to control the limit as you get more and more points. But I'm not going to do that today. What I'll do now is I'll set up the analog of this formula here when space R3 is just replaced by some finite number of points that I'm going to call x. When I do that, I'll write it down pretty explicitly in a second, then the left-hand side becomes obviously well-defined. The right-hand side is still not going to be well, obviously well-defined, and that's what we're going to put most of our effort into. All right, so let's see, I will attempt to save this formal integral here. Now here, the only thing that we care about here is this top line, so I'm going to try to, or maybe a bit more, save this much, and try to keep it obstructing the other detector. Yeah, but we don't need the bottom stuff anyway. All right, so what we're going to do is we're now thinking of space, instead of being R3, we think of space as being a finite number of points. So now our Hilbert space becomes a lot simpler. So a Hilbert space of allowed states is still an orthogonal direct sum. F subscript n is still the Hilbert space that you would have if there were exactly n particles. But now this n sum n is a finite dimensional vector space. If there were exactly one particle, that vector space would just be C to a power. The power is the number of points in space. So it's a vector where the number of components is the number of points in space. Roughly speaking, the significance of component number 5 is that that's the thing that determines the probability that the particle is at point number 5 in your space. If you've got 2 points, then you've got 2 copies of this thing, except it's slightly complicated because the particles are supposed to be indistinguishable, so you'd have to mod out by some permutations. That level of detail doesn't matter. It's the nth sum end is a finite dimensional vector space. Furthermore, both the Hamiltonian and the number operator leave invariant each of these subspaces. Consequently, the operator whose trace we're attempting to take, E minus beta times H minus mu n, leaves invariant each of the subspaces. So to compute the trace, what we can do is we can first compute the trace in each subspace. So here it is. Here's the thing whose trace we want to take. This means we take the trace but restricted to the subspace. That's now a trace of a matrix with finitely many rows and columns. It's obviously well-defined. The only question is, can you perform the sum over n of all of these different contributions? And I claim it's trivial that you can, because we have the following information about these operators. The number operator on the n particle subspace, we know exactly. Every single, it's n times the identity. Every eigenvalue is exactly n. Now, I haven't defined what the Hamiltonian is, but I'll give you the one piece of information that you can get from it rather easily. Every eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian is at least a positive constant, a strictly positive constant, times n squared, plus some lower order contributions, some things that grow smaller, as a smaller power of n. This is where the repulsive nature of the potential came in. Yes, it does. So this is not going to be uniform in X, but remember, for today's talk, X is fixed, so I don't need to worry about that. For any, it doesn't matter what, how many it is, but it's got to be fixed. All right, so now if I take the operator that we're interested in, this e to the minus beta, we know that every eigenvalue of this operator, well, beta and H commute, so we can get simultaneous eigenvectors. Every eigenvalue of this operator is at most basically e to the minus a positive constant times n squared multiplied by some things that are growing like e to the n to the power 1. That's each eigenvalue. To get a bound on the trace, we also need to know the dimension of the space. The dimension of the space is smaller than x to the n. If there were no permutations being modded out, it would be exactly x to the power n. With the permutations being modded out, that brings it down, but I don't care. I'll just get as an upper bound x to the n. And so we've got the trace over the n particle part of this behaving like e to the minus a positive constant times n squared times something which is growing at worst like e to a constant times n. That obviously converges trivially as you sum over n. So the trace, the left-hand side, is now obviously well-defined. What we'd like to have is we'd like to have the analog of this formula in our current setting. And now when we take a look at the right-hand side, it's pretty obvious what you should do to the right-hand side. And it's also pretty obvious that it's not obvious that the right-hand side is well-defined. Because when you look at the measure, it's true that the parameter x now only takes finitely many values. But the time parameter tau still runs continuously from 0 to beta. So you've still got uncountably many integration variables. What you do with the integrand, that you do the obvious thing. You write down the integrand you had before, and you put in the obvious restriction so that it only involves the integration variables you're talking about. That's harmless. Now, if you're a probabilist at this stage, you say, aha, I know what's going on here. First of all, let's just fix x. And look at, think of phi sub tau. Tau is running as continuously from 0 to beta, so we have a path. Okay, now as this little x varies over the finite number of possibilities, what you've essentially got is you've got a path with time running from 0 to beta, and with the path taking values in a finite dimensional vector space. Right, the dimension is basically 2 times the number of, the real dimension is 2 times the number of points in space. All right. So I've got a path. Sounds an awful lot like I've got something like Brownian motion or something like that. And I know how to set up integrals to handle Brownian motion. Of course, the Lebesgue part of this measure, you're not going to get well defined. But if you're talking about Brownian motion or Gaussian measures like it, there's a well-oiled machine that you can use to build them. What you do is you take a portion of the integrand away from the integrand. It's a part that looks like e to a quadratic form in the integration variables. And you put that into the measure so that instead of having a Lebesgue measure, you've now got a Gaussian measure. And you've got a beautiful machine for building Gaussian measures on space of paths using cylinder measures. And it works great. There's only one problem here. And that is there's a big difference between this sort of integral and the integrals that you get with Brownian motion. And the difference is that the exponent here is complex. And in Brownian motion, it's not. It's real. And in fact, there's a well-known calculation that goes back to Cameron in 1960, which goes something like this. So I'll tell you what the Gaussian measure version of that calculation is. But it applies here as well. Suppose you want to build a Gaussian measure in infinite dimensions. So, see, I have the computation here actually in detail, but I'm not going to take the time to go through it. I'll just tell you roughly what happens. So here I have something that looks, this is a finite dimensional Gaussian measure, right? You've got an exponential of a quadratic form, and here we're imagining we're in dimension n, but we want to take the limit as n goes to infinity. Now this C here, the covariance, is supposed to be a positive definite operator to be sure that the integral converges. But now take this C and multiply it by a parameter sigma. So you're scaling the covariance up and down. But allow sigma to be a complex number. Now, of course, you better be sure that the real part of sigma is positive so that you still have things which converge. Nonetheless, if the imaginary, no matter how small the imaginary part of sigma is, as long as it's non-zero, when you take the limit as n goes to infinity, you get oscillations occurring that are so wild here that it causes your well-oiled machine to pop a piston. It just ain't going to work. There's no way in the world you're going to get a well-defined complex measure out of something like this. And exactly the same phenomena occurs in the thing that we're interested in, this expression here. Well, you take a look at what this thing is, and you'll see that it's not. Of course, that we're each phi. These phis are complex things, and if you just substitute them in here, you see that, right? You don't have something times its complex conjugate. You get things which are complex valued coming out of it when you just take a look at what A is. Yeah. Yeah, no, but let me get back what the A is, and I'll show you one term here. You have, for example, this thing here. That's right, and that's not going to be real. Okay, now... That's the form you should have, yeah. Now, in fact, this doesn't bother me. As far as I'm concerned, what that's telling me is that it's an aesthetic problem. The expression I'm going to get is going to be something which doesn't look particularly pretty, but I don't care whether it looks pretty or not. I want to have something that I can analyze and work with to attempt to control the limit as the number of points in space gets bigger and bigger. Okay, whether it looks pretty or not, well, I don't care. I've got to be able to work with it. And sure enough, there is a rigorous version of this thing here, which I will now state as our conclusion. So here's the main theorem, and I'll spend a little bit of time explaining the statement of this theorem. So you'll notice that the left-hand side is our partition function. The right-hand side is not one integral, but it's a limit of integrals. Okay, and I'll explain what this limit of integrals are. I want to make sure that the integral that I have, each term in the limit, is well-defined. And the way I'll do that is by taking the original measure, which had parameters x running over a finite number of points. That's fixed. That's fine. That's harmless. But I'll take tau, which is supposed to run over a continuous interval from 0 to beta, and I'll approximate that continuous interval by a finite number of points. Just partition it into some number of intervals, just for convenience, make them of equal length. I'm going to call the number of intervals p. So if I take the interval from 0 to beta, and I partition it into p subintervals, the first dividing point is going to be beta divided by p, the next one's 2 beta divided by p, and so on. That's going to be my allowed times. Now, eventually, I am going to take the limit as the number of points in this partition goes to infinity. All right, so here is the beginning of our measure. So first of all, I'll hide this part for a second. So this is a Lebesgue measure that looks a lot like the Lebesgue measure we had before, except now it's finite dimensional, because x only runs over finitely many points, tau runs over finitely many values, so we've got a Lebesgue measure on a space of real dimension 2 times p times the number of points in x. To make life even easier, I'm going to restrict the measure even more. I'm going to prevent phi from getting too big. So I'm going to force each integration variable to be smaller than some radius r. So we're going to have a bunch of disks centered on the origin. All right, so now this measure is not only a well-defined Lebesgue measure, but it's a finite mass. And that's the measure which appears in this integral. Except that when I take the limit as the number of points goes to infinity, I need to make this radius bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So each individual integral is an integral with respect to a measure of finite mass, but the mass is growing as we go farther up in the limit. For the integrand, again, you just do the obvious thing. You take the integrand you care about and write down the obvious approximation to it that only involves the integration variables that we're talking about. And then the theorem is that if you take this finite dimensional integral, it's obviously well defined. The integrand is bounded and continuous, and the total mass of the measure is finite, so each individual integral is obviously well defined. You take the limit as the number of points in your partition of time to infinity, the result is exactly the trace we want. Okay, now the proof of this thing goes through four steps. The first three steps, I would call them soft and conceptual. So, in fact, I'm going to be able to explain the bulk of the, at least schematically, what's going on in those first three steps. The last step, I wouldn't call it exactly hard. It's only maybe 10 to 20 pages. But it's grungy and boring. So I'm going to leave that part out. If we get to it, I'll tell you what you have to do, but I'll say it in one line instead of 20 pages of estimates. All right, now these first three steps involve some special vectors in our Hilbert space, and they're standard vectors for physicists, but I'll explain to you what they are. They're called coherent states. They kind of play the role sort of like an orthonormal basis in the Hilbert space, but it's a special basis in quotation marks. Okay, now, just to explain what coherent states are, I'm going to, for pedagogical reasons, consider only an extreme case. Remember, we've taken space R3, and we've replaced R3 by a finite number of points. Now, we're thinking of this as a large finite number of points, but for pedagogical purposes, I'm going to pretend we've taken one point. And I'll write down all the formulae for the case when space consists of a single point. To get any finite number of points, conceptually it's exactly the same argument, just that the formula get messier, that's all. So suppose space consists of a single point. Then our Hilbert space becomes really easy. It's still an orthogonal direct sum, it's still infinite dimensional. F sub n is a subspace that you would have if there were exactly n particles. Now, if they're exactly n particles, and they all have to be at the same point, that's still a one degree of freedom situation. It's one dimensional. So the n particle subspace has got dimension exactly one. It's the complex numbers. And there's an obvious vector to take as the basis vector for this subspace, namely the number one in the complex plane. So I'm going to call E subscript n the number one in the complex plane, but where this complex plane is viewed as the n particle subspace in this orthogonal direct sum. So I now have an orthonormal basis for our Hilbert space, all of these ENs. And here is a formula for the coherent states. Now there are lots of coherent states. There's a one parameter family of coherent states given by a complex, the parameters are complex number phi. And the phi, so this left-hand side is physicist notation for the coherent state with parameter phi. And it's just this expression I've written out in terms of the given basis. Now, in fact, this is a formula which is not picked at random. There's a good reason for it, but I don't want to explain the reason because these things are eigenvectors for some special operators that play an important role in all of this. Except I don't want to actually introduce those operators at all. I don't want to talk about them. So I'm just going to pick this formula out of the air and say this is the definition of the phi coherent state. Now, I want to think of these things as being, roughly speaking, as sort of like an orthonormal basis. But clearly it can't be an orthonormal basis. For one thing, there are too many of them. Right? There are uncountably many values of phi. Whereas the Hilbert space we're talking about is separable. Its dimension is countable.
And that's just
phi
to the nth power?
This is the complex number phi raised to the nth power, exactly, multiplying the nth basis vector and then a 1 over square root of n factorial. That's it. Now, one thing that's going to be important is the inner product between two of these coherent states, and it's easy to compute. And so here's the answer down here. So this is physicist notation for the inner product between the alpha-th coherent state and the gamma-th coherent state. And of course, this inner product is easy to compute because the ENs are an orthonormal basis. All right, so you go ahead, you multiply them together. The double sum collapses to a single sum because of the orthonormality. So you have, I put the complex conjugates on the left-hand side. That's the mathematical physicist convention. So you're going to have alpha complex conjugate to the nth power times gamma to the nth power. The 2 square root of n's gives a 1 over n factorial. You've got an exponential series, and you get e to the complex conjugate of alpha times gamma. Okay, now this is the formula you have for the inner product when space consists of a single point. If we have a general finite number of points, then there are again coherent states, except instead of one parameter phi, you've got one parameter phi for each point in space. So you've got c to the number to the power of the number of points in x. And there's a formula for the inner product. It's kind of the obvious formula. This integral is, that's just the sum over the number of points in space. All right, so these are coherent states. All right, and so now we're ready to start the proof. So what I'm going to do is over here, I'm going to write down and outline the steps that we go through in the proof. So the first thing I'm going to do, so is this going to be visible now? Maybe we need a little bit of light. So I'm going to take trace of e to the minus beta times h minus mu times the number operator. So this is the thing that whose trace we want to have. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take this exponential, and I'm just going to write it as a, I'm going to pick a number p, an integer p, and I'm going to write it as p, a product of p, pth roots of this thing. Okay, so this is exactly equal to e to the minus beta over p. That's the first factor. And then a second factor, beta over p, h minus mu. And we keep going, and we have p of them all together, e to the minus beta over p, h minus mu n. And we need to take the trace of this. Now, of course, this is true for every single p. It's independent of p. So in fact, it's equal to the limit as p goes to infinity of this thing. Okay, that's now the first thing I'm going to do is between these operators here, I'm going to insert the identity written in a very complicated way. Let's see. So over here, I'll write in step one. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write out the analog of writing the identity operator in the following way. Suppose, so this is the analog in coherent or using coherent states. Of the following formula, which you teach in first year linear algebra. Of course, you do it with finite dimensional vector spaces, but that doesn't matter. Suppose you have a Hilbert space, and you have an orthonormal basis, and you have a vector in that Hilbert space, and you want to write out in terms of its components in that basis. So what you're doing is you're taking the identity operator applied to V, and you're writing it as the sum over the index, which is running over the different the indices for your orthonormal basis. And then you take the inner product of the nth basis vector with V, multiplied by the nth basis vector, and that's true. Now, there's an analog for this formula, but with the ENs replaced by coherent states. And this formula appears in, again, it's a standard formula in physics books. And again, it's a formula where you have to give it a little bit of thought before you decide whether, yeah, so we're going to have, we need to have an audiovisual technician. Okay, so here is the formula that you see in physics textbooks. Now, I have to explain a little bit about the notation here. First of all, this bit at the end. This is a notation for a certain operator. And the way this operator acts, so here's the operator, the way this operator acts when you apply it to a vector v in your Hilbert space is you take the inner product of v with a coherent state. So that's this part here. Right? You take this part, you take the inner product with v. That's now a number. So that's just like taking this inner product here. And then you multiply by the vector phi. That's this part here. And you add them up. That's the integral. Now, the only catch is the way I've defined things, these phis are not normalized. They're not unit vectors. And that's why there's this extra factor here. This is dividing by the square of the length of these things here. Now, as usual, we're in an infinite dimensional setting. You've got to be a little bit careful about in what sense this thing converges. But in fact, it's pretty easy to analyze. And so here's a rigorous version of it. So what I'll do first of all is I'll get an approximation where instead of integrating over all phis, I integrate only a disk over a disk of radius r. When I integrate over a disk of radius r, this integral becomes obviously norm convergent because this operator here, including this factor and this part here, this is something of norm at most 1. So you're integrating something of norm at most 1 over something with a measure of finite mass, so it obviously converges in norm. So I'm going to think of this I sub r as an approximation to the identity. Eventually I'm going to take r big. And it's very easy actually to analyze this thing and get a lot of detailed information about it. The reason is it's easy to find all of the eigenvalues and all of the eigenvectors for this. Okay, now in fact I won't go through, I mean I've got the computation on the slides, but we're kind of running late on time, so I won't go through it, but I'll tell you what the idea is. If space consisted of a single point, then we've got an orthonormal basis, namely these ENs, the complex number 1 in each of the sum ends. Those are exactly the eigenvectors for this thing. And, of course, as soon as you know the eigenvectors, you compute the eigenvalue. You just apply to that and see what comes out. And what you see when you do that is that every eigenvalue lies between 0 and 1. The fact that the ENs are eigenvectors tells you that each of these things leaves each of the n particle sum ends invariant. It commutes with the number operator. And furthermore, you can see as r gets bigger and bigger, each eigenvalue approaches 1. So as r gets bigger and bigger, this converges strongly to the identity. And in fact, you can get quite detailed information. You can see it doesn't quite converge in norm. So here is the error, the difference between the identity and its approximator, restricted to the n particle subspace. And you see it converges as r goes to infinity, it converges very quickly to 1, but it's not happening uniform in the index n. That's the only thing that prevents norm convergence. So you know an awful lot about this thing. So what I'm going to do in the next step is in here, instead of inserting an identity between each of these guys, I'm going to insert one of these approximate identities. We've got so much control over this that we'll know that as long as we take r to infinity with p at an appropriate rate, we're going to get convergence. Okay, so that's the next step. That's the first thing we do is in here, we put in one of these approximate identities with a radius chosen depending on p, I'm going to call it r of p. In fact, you can have this r of p growing quite slowly. Something just a little bit faster than the square root of the logarithm of p is going to work because you've got this e to the minus r squared here. So you put in one of these things everywhere here. Including at the end. Okay, now remember that the definition of this operator involves an integral. So we're starting to see, I'm going to be back over here most of the time now. I don't know. We'll see. There aren't very many more steps to go, and I have to hurry up. Soon. Now, when am I supposed to stop? At 4:30 on the nose. Okay, so we don't need a 10-minute break to allow people to get to their next class. Okay. All right. So for each of these i's, we now have an integral. It's an integral over phi. Okay, so here we have an integral over phi. Here we have another integral over phi. Here we have another integral over phi. Of course, I don't want to use the same integration variable for all of these different integrals, so I need to put an index on it. And for this first one, well, I'm going to call it index tau. This first one is going to be an integral over, so it's a 2 real dimensional phi, right, is just d2 phi, with an index tau on it. And for this first one, the value of tau I'm going to assign to be beta over pi, beta over p. So tau, with this tau being beta over p. And for the second one, I'm going to have an integral, and I'm going to call in its index again tau, but this time the value of tau is going to be 2 beta over p. And I keep going all the way, and I do this for all of them except for the very last one. Leave this one just as I by itself. Okay, so now what do I have? I've got a whole bunch of integrals, but I still have a trace left to deal with. And then I've got a complicated operator. I don't care about that. And then there's an I on the end. Fortunately, step two, we have another formula that is the analog for coherent states of something just like this. This is step two, except, let's see the... Let's see, move this up. So step two is going to be the analog for using coherent states. Of a formula for a trace. All right, what's the standard formula for the trace of any operator if you've got an orthonormal basis? It's just the sum over the index of the inner product of En operator applied to En. Okay, and so now I'm going to do exactly the same thing, except I'm going to replace all of the Ens by my coherent states that are acting an awful lot like a basis. Okay. It is a basis in an inappropriate sense. Yeah, it's an overcomplete basis. That's true. All right, and so now here's the formula for it. Let's see. A couple of pages down the line. Now, the way I'm going to do things, I'm going to rig things. This is not nowhere near the most general formula you can have, but it's rigged to be exactly what we want. We want to have a trace of an operator with one of these approximate identities tacked on the end. And what we have is exactly this thing here. And this looks like, so what do we have here? We've got phi inner product with b phi. That's just like the en b en. We have the sum over n, that's the integral here. Again, this e to the minus phi squared, that's just because the phi's are not unit vectors. That compensates for that. The fact that we've got an IR on the end, what it does is it limits the domain of integration to phi's of magnitude at most r. So in fact, this integral that we have here is exactly the same measure as we had in the definition of our approximate identity operator r. The only difference is that now over here we have an inner product instead of this funny operator with the bra and the ket in the wrong order. All right, so the next step is I take this formula and I apply it over here. That gets rid of the trace. It gets rid of the last IR and replaces it with one last integral. Okay, so let's see. Actually, now, at this stage, I can save you from jumping up and down because I have this on a slide. I'll write down what we have at this point. Okay, so what do we have? All right, so this... Here, this gives the first couple of steps that I've written on the board. All right, we started off by taking the exponential, writing it as a product of p factors of p-th roots, inserting approximate identities, then applying our trace formula, And we now have a whole bunch of integrals. In fact, this is exactly the measure we want to have. So the measure is now perfect. The problem now is that the integrand is not perfect. We have these expressions here that we have to somehow turn into the integrand we want. So step three, the third soft step, is to somehow get a handle on these things here in our integrand. Unfortunately, that's also something that's pretty easy to do. Here's a proposition. I think it wasn't hard enough to call it a theorem, which gives us the structure of each of these factors. Pardon? Yeah. So here, epsilon is going to be. So this is a proposition which is valid for any positive epsilon. We're going to apply it with epsilon being this beta over p in the applications. We do not use that epsilon is small. But you'll see. Let me explain. Okay. There is going to be a reason that when epsilon is small, it does make a difference, and you'll see. Now the thing is that if you take, it's pretty easy from what we know. If you just take a look at the left-hand side here, this thing here is a function of this alpha and of this phi. And in fact, it's very easy to see that this is an entire function for any positive epsilon at all. This is an entire function of these phis. That's some complex numbers, certain number of complex variables, and the complex conjugate of these alphas. Okay, that's a two-line computation to see that that's the case. The thing that we've got to be careful about is that we want to have the logarithm of this. And what is not clear is whether this thing vanishes. You know, so you start running into the branch cut of a logarithm. And in fact, it's very easy to do a computation to see that it does. If phi gets too big or alpha gets too big, you're going to have zeros. The question is, how far can you go before you hit them? And the answer is that you can take the logarithm on the left-hand side, so you can take the left-hand side, or right is e to the something or rather, providing your alphas and your phis are not too big. And how big you can make them depends upon epsilon. And if epsilon is really small, which is what's going to happen, you can make these alphas and phis very big. Otherwise, you can't. Now, in fact, it's very easy to prove this. I'll just tell you in words how you go about it. What you do is you differentiate this formula with respect to epsilon. And when you do that, you're going to get a differential equation. It's actually, do I have it written down here somewhere? I think it's on the next page. It doesn't matter. You get a mixed integral differential equation for this f that you want to compute. And of course, you can integrate it up to get an integral equation for f. So you've now got you integrate epsilon from 0 to whatever. So you've now got an integral equation for this f, and you solve the integral equation the obvious way. You iterate it. And all you've got to do is you've got to get enough estimates to see how far you can push the iteration. And it's something it's tedious, but it's a few pages. It's something that's easy to do. That's essentially what you're doing here. Exactly. That's essentially what you're doing. That's right. And in fact, what we're going to do is when we take this f, we're interested in expanding it in powers of epsilon. And in fact, the zeroth power of epsilon is trivial to get. When epsilon is exactly zero, you've got the inner product of alpha and phi. We know exactly what that is. It's e to the alpha complex conjugate times phi. That's this first term in f. And the term that's of order epsilon is also pretty easy to get. And that's exactly what we want for the rest of our integrand. So in fact, if the result stopped here, we'd be finished. We'd have exactly the integral that we wanted. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite stop here. There are things of order epsilon squared and higher. Now, if you just look naively, they look pretty harmless. Because what's epsilon going to be? It's going to be beta over p. And they're going to be p. So if you take this product of exponentials, right, e to a sum. You're going to have a sum of p terms. If you've got something of order epsilon squared, that's order, that's basically 1 over p squared. So you've got p terms, each of order 1 over p squared, that's something of order 1 over p. As p goes to infinity, that's going to go to 0. The only problem is that there's a coefficient multiplying that. That coefficient depends on what phi and alpha are, and it grows rather quickly. So what you have to do is you have to show, despite the fact that you've got these coefficients that are getting big, that the 1 over p still wins out. And that's this grungy part at the end that I'm not going to say anything about. And so that's it. You take the limit as p goes to infinity, this part goes away, and you substitute this in here, and you've got exactly the integral that you want. And that's it. That's basically the end of the proof. Any questions?